This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the situation in the Middle East is getting very serious. There was a major escalation on Saturday night when Iran launched 300 missiles and drones at the Israelis. A lot of danger. However, the Iranians had signaled through Turkey to the United States that this attack was going to take place. Israel had time to prepare. The reason the Iranians wanted to do this was because Israel had hit a target, an Iranian consulate in Damascus, the capital of Syria, 2 weeks ago, which took out a number of people and senior members of the Iranian Defense Forces were killed in that. So there is a fear, and in one London newspaper this morning, that we're looking at World War III. It may not be that serious, but it is serious to talk about that, and indeed about the fact that Micheál Martin, Foreign Minister, Minister for Defence, is sending 33 more Irish troops to serve for UNIFIL as peacekeepers. And we're joined by Tom Clonan. Tom is an Irish senator, of course. He's a security analyst. He's an author and retired Irish army captain. And he led the victorious side in the recent referendum in the care, the matter of care and responsibility for care. Good morning, Tom. It's good to talk to you, and congratulations on your victory in the referendum and your side's victory, should I say, because it was a very important matter.
Yeah, we were very relieved, and over a million Irish people voted for the rights of disabled people to have independent lives outside the family. We just hope the government is listening.
Yes, indeed. This situation, Tom, you served UNIFIL in the Lebanon in this precise place where 33 extra Irish troops are going now. How dangerous and threatening is it? And what is the UNIFIL role?
Yeah, so from the point of view of the UN Security Council resolution, UNIFIL, the United Nations interim force in Lebanon, we've had Irish troops in South Lebanon on and off almost continuously since the 1970s. And so the mission is to kind of act as the eyes and ears of the international community in the hostilities between Hezbollah, on the one hand, which is the Iranian-backed Islamic resistance group, which has become very, very powerful in southern Lebanon and really pose a very significant threat and a credible and capable threat to the Israeli Defense Forces. And then the Israelis on the other side, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. And I suppose in the last 48 hours, the Israelis have targeted South Lebanon for airstrikes, as they have been more or less continuously since the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel, that reprehensible attack. So in the last day or two, they hit Daira and a place called Nakura. And that's where the UNIFIL headquarters is, and it's not far from where Irish troops are based. And so the decision to send 33 extra peacekeepers, for people to understand, I mean, we've been in Lebanon for so long, it's entered into the Irish kind of vocabulary, Lebanon or the Lebanon.
Yes.
But For people to understand what it's like on a day to day, because the Defence Forces, unfortunately, are not great at telling their own story. There's a kind of a reluctance or a hesitancy on the part of the Óglaigh na hÉireann to tell their own story. But basically, they're human shields between the two sides. And in 96, when I was there, we had a period of Israeli aggression called Operation Grapes of Wrath, where they saturated the Irish area of operations with airstrikes, helicopter gunship attacks, missile attacks, heavy artillery from their positions at Gate 14 Alpha and Gate. These are big artillery firing sites inside Israeli territory, and they just saturated our area of operations. And for Irish soldiers, and for what's going to happen with our troops in the next couple of weeks, is it means that when we come under fire like that, and it's direct fire, you're coming under direct fire, you have to take cover. And so in all of the fortified positions that we have, the positions are fortified with big, huge gabions. These are blast walls. Gabions are big steel kind of cages filled with rock, sandbags. And we have our gun positions to provide all-round security of our fortified posts there. So the extra layer of security then, when you come under direct fire, is to go into what we call fortified bunkers. These are often, usually subterranean, they're underground, very, very heavily fortified, reinforced kind of concrete positions. But only non-essential staff go into the bunkers during what we call groundhog. The remainder of the staff, the people who are troops that are providing the all-around security, our signalers in the communication centres, our operations staff, they all have to remain at their posts under fire. And that's why, you know, in our history in Lebanon, we've taken casualties, and approximately 50% of our casualties in Lebanon have been inflicted by the Israelis and their proxy forces, and the other 50% by Islamic resistance groups such as Hezbollah. So we're literally piggy in the middle. What happens are, like, so we endured 6-7 weeks of continuous fire back in 96. And after a while, you very quickly you become sleep deprived.
Yes.
Because it's 24/7. You're constantly going to and from the bunkers, or as in our case, going out in the armored vehicles to, you know, try to assist the civilian population. People, you know, our engineers would fire up big diesel generators and use consoles to cut down through the twisted concrete and metal wreckage of homes to take out the bodies of children, infants, elderly people. So that's the scenario that our troops will face in the coming weeks. I think, the risk of this happening is very, very high. And just so people know, when you go into the bunkers, you know, they're underground, they're cold, they're dark, they're damp, and you've got a lot of mosquitoes in there.
Yes.
It's not like they're all down there boiling up the kettle and drinking tea while all hell breaks loose. Like, it is like every other army in the world. You know, you're under fire. After a period of extended shelling, some of the troops may bring, you know, try to bring a mattress in with them, bring a sleeping bag, just try and maybe if they can snatch a little bit of sleep, they'll have their weapons with them. And again, this is the story of our troops that really isn't told very often, or isn't told very effectively. I think there's a kind of a nervousness on the part of the military authorities to tell the story, because they're afraid that it'll worry families. But I think it's important for people to understand the risk that our troops are experiencing. And
they're serving for the United Nations.
Absolutely.
And the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, has been very vocal about this dispute between Hamas and Israel, and ultimately between Iran and Israel now. All of these players are hard. None of them like the UN, and in particular, Israel has been condemned repeatedly by Guterres and the UN. So you're surrounded by hostile forces.
And this is a very dangerous moment. And you and I, Eamon, will remember 1979. It was actually February 1979 when the Ayatollahs deposed the Shah of Iran.
Yeah.
And took over and created the Islamic Revolutionary Republic of Iran. And, you know, with all of those chants and signs of death to America, death to Israel, But in the last 45 years, the Iranians have been very, very careful never to directly confront the state of Israel. They have carried out their campaign against Israel by way of proxy groups in the region.
Yes.
Hezbollah, which is a Shia-backed militia, very effective fighting force with over 150,000 drones and missiles in their arsenal. And we've got Hamas, which unusually for Iran is a Sunni Palestinian group that they've backed. The Houthis, which are Shia in Yemen. And so there's a kind of a Shia versus Sunni conflict in the Middle East that's been there historically. And Iran has risen into the ascendancy in recent decades post US invasion and failed occupation of Iraq. The Iranians, and this is crucial, now enjoy an arc of influence from Tehran through Baghdad, through Damascus, right over to Beirut on the Mediterranean with Sheikh Nasrallah. And they have a land corridor to bring troops, reinforcements, weapons and ammunition right up to the border with northern Israel. And that's why the Israelis struck at the Iranian consulate in Damascus to take out senior Republican Guard figures, Mohammad Rezi Zahidi and Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, who are two of their senior Quds commanders who come under the direct authority of the Supreme Commander, the Ayatollah al-Khamenei. So for the first time in 45 years, in response to that attack, Iran has done what most of us would have considered was unthinkable. They've launched a direct interstate, explicit act of war on the state of Israel. And they fired over 300 missiles and drones on Saturday night. That is a game changer. That is, we're at a precipitous moment. Because even Israel, in its attack on the consulate in Damascus, they didn't claim responsibility for it. It was a covert action, if you want to call it that, a kind of a part of their shadow war of terrorism and intimidation in the region. But now we have an open act of war. The Israeli war cabinet were persuaded on Sunday not to take immediate action by President Biden, but they met again yesterday and they've sent several signals. They're saying their chief military spokesperson, who's been the principal commentator on their catastrophic war, you know, their horrific campaign in Gaza, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, has said that the war cabinet has now approved and what he calls offensive and defensive action against Iran. And Netanyahu has said that they will retaliate in a manner and time of their own choosing, which is now rumored to be imminent. So I suppose the question is, what will that look like?
Yes, and Iran has responded to that by saying the next time their action would be even more severe. And it should be said, Tom, that Iran, the American intelligence community, and indeed others, knew what was coming on Saturday night before those 300 missiles were launched. And Iran felt they had to do it after what happened in Damascus and the killing of those figures that you mentioned. They didn't try to take Israel by surprise, and they have said that as far as Iran is concerned, that's it. They don't want to go any further. But the Israelis at the moment are in a particularly aggressive mood. Can you explain to us the dangers of escalation here? The US, for example, in an election year, the consequence of this, for example, if Israel and Iran go at it and this becomes regional, that oil prices go up, the Suez Canal will be out of operation. All kinds of consequences flow, don't they? Not to mention,
I think that a lot of the sort of commentary and analysis here in the last number of days has been very, I would say, dominated by British so-called defense think tanks and US funded think tanks. I don't think that the analysis has quite got to grips with what happened on Saturday night. So the risks are very clear. It's very important to remember Iran's principal military ally is Vladimir Putin. Yes. They have participated in the invasion of Ukraine by sending ammunition, weapons, drones. Yes. And every week now, because of the I suppose, erosion of support for Zelensky's defense of Ukraine. The Russians have been, and Putin has been, firing precisely the type of missile and drone mix at Ukrainian cities and energy infrastructure that the Iranians launched on Saturday night. So the Iranians were sending a message to the state of Israel. We don't care who your supporters are. We don't care how much military power you have. We can send 300 missiles every night. And in fact, Hezbollah and Lebanon alone have about 150,000 missiles and drones. They could fire 300 missiles a night, every night, for the next 500 nights, for the next 2 years. And it cost the Americans. So the missile defense was shored up by the Americans, the French, four RAF Typhoons out of their airbase in Cyprus. They had two aircraft carrier battle groups in the Gulf, in the Eastern Mediterranean. Like, that's what it took to stop all of the missiles. The Americans took out about 60 or 70 of them. In total, the coordination was handled by US CENTCOM, Central Command. So they assisted Israel in the missile defense. But it cost the estimates vary, but it cost over $1 billion to halt that 300 missile attack on Sunday night. So the challenge for the West will be, can we do this every night for the next however long that Israel and Iran slug it out in what will be an unwinnable war for either side? But the principal victim on Saturday night, Eamon, was Ukraine. Because once the United States and the British and the French, these are the principal allies of Ukraine, as soon as they have to divert their resources and their strategic weapon stockpiles to support Israel in a war against Iran, then I think the defense of Ukraine is seriously compromised.
Right.
And it puts Zelensky under serious pressure. What's going to happen next? I mean, you have this Israeli war cabinet. It's made up of three individuals. Yoav Gallant, who's a very, very hawkish defense minister, who said very recently during the Gaza campaign that as soon as he's finished with Hamas, he wants to start a war on the northern front with Hezbollah. This was before even this attack happened. We have Benny Gantz, a former defense minister, who's also hawkish. I think he's the one who called for immediate action and supports this idea of Israel going berserk. And then you have Benjamin Netanyahu. So past behavior is the best prediction for future behavior. After the reprehensible October 7th attack, the genocidal attack on Israeli settlements and kibbutzim and positions, Benjamin Netanyahu has presided over a campaign in Gaza, which has killed over 33,000 people, the vast majority of them civilians, innocent men, women and children. So that's his sort of modus operandi, the indiscriminate and overwhelming use of force. Now, to get back to first principles here, Israel has been attacked by another state openly. And for the last 2 years, the narrative has been around Ukraine, that if a country is attacked, it has the right to defend itself. So Israel will, using that logic and consistent with that narrative and that discourse, will retaliate. My guess is they will meet like with like. They will carry out missile and, ballistic and cruise missile attacks themselves, I think, throughout Lebanon and throughout targets in Iran. And they'll be seeking to try and make sure that Iran can't do this with such ease again. You know, they'll attack weapons stockpiles, weapons depots, places where missiles are stored, command and control centers. So it'll be a very wide, my guess is it will be a very wide ranging and very in-depth attack on Iranian and Hezbollah in Lebanon facilities. But they'll also accompany it with attacks from the Israeli Air Force to raise the stakes. Right, we've met your missile and your drone attack with missiles and drones, but we're also going to add in our considerable air power. And when I say they attack command and control centers and probably some of the nuclear reprocessing sites that are believed to be to exist in places like Natanz and Isfahan, when you say command and control, that's people. They'll inflict lots and lots of casualties, and they'll create a lot of infrastructural damage in Iran and I suspect also in Lebanon. And then you're into your, you know, what G7 have called the uncontrollable regional escalation. which they say must be avoided. So if you were using the calm calculus of reason, then you would say Israel ought to be, you know, temperate in its response. But we're not dealing with reasonable people. We're dealing with a cast of regional yes. characters, from an autocratic religious fanatic like Ali al-Khamenei.
Yeah.
Sheikh Nasrallah in Beirut, who is hell-bent on the destruction of Israel. And then, you know, we've got Benjamin Netanyahu. So the risk for regional escalation is high. The Gulf states, the Sunni states, who fear Iran as much as Israel does, possibly even more so, they'll be quite happy to watch Iran and Israel slug it out and deplete their resources. And in terms of the broader global picture, China and Russia will watch with great interest
yes.
as, you know, Israel and her allies, you know, held in a headlock of support, will expend trillions of dollars worth of weapons and ammunition while they look at Ukraine. And in time, China will look more and more closely at Taiwan. And that's the,
yes.
the you know, the domino effect, that much maligned phrase, was it Nixon used it
yes.
To refer to, you know, Southeast Asia. But so there is a risk of regional and then a broader global escalation or disinhibition in relation to the use of force and violence as a central tool of foreign policy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Would it be fair to say, Tom, that Biden in particular has been passive and supportive of the Israelis in what they've done in Gaza and are continuing to do in Gaza and proposing to do by going into Rafah, where there are over a million Gazans who have fled the north and are now in the south? It would be a bloodbath if the Israelis go there. But we in the West, I mean, France, as you've pointed out, helped the Israelis the other night. The UK are regarded as allies, and of course, the United States. So we are allies of Israel, who are committing the most appalling war crimes and genocide. And you're telling us how this will look, the people who are talking about the Third World War, but how it will weaken the West morally as much as anything else.
But yeah, well, we've entered a period of global instability, and the situation at the moment is very fluid. It's very dynamic. The United States has lost much of its diplomatic, military, political and moral sort of standing because of the Trump presidency, which talked yes. down the NATO alliance, which talked up Putin. And Biden as president you know, I have, he's been led by the nose, unfortunately. I used the expression earlier, like, the United States is in a kind of a headlock, held in a headlock by Benjamin Netanyahu, because he knows that the United States and Britain and France and her principal allies will support Israel's legitimate right to defend itself. But Netanyahu, in my view, has been quite clearly committing war crimes. But they will argue that Hamas has and continues also to commit war crimes, that Hezbollah commits war crimes when they fire rockets and missiles indiscriminately into northern Israel, and that the stated aim of Iran, the Iranian regime, and Hezbollah and Hamas is the complete destruction of Israel. So yes, we have these really toxic narratives. What has been absent has been good leadership. So all the difficult but very positive negotiations that took place in the past on the two-state solution have, for the last 10 years, for the last decade, have been allowed to just, you know, under Netanyahu's stewardship, all of that has just stopped. And we've seen increasingly the greater and greater use of force and violence against, you know, what the Israelis call mowing the grass, to further persecute the Palestinians. And that feeds into the narrative of Hezbollah. It feeds into the narrative of the Iranians. And here we are. We're at this precipitous moment. Guterres, who you mentioned earlier, said, you know, this, we need to, as collectively, step back from the brink. But in the past, we had different leaders. You know, at the moment, yes, as I said, it's a cast of religious autocrats and fanatics. You know, the great people of Israel, the Palestinians, are let down by their leaders, very much so. And globally, so the local or regional leadership cast of characters is grim. But globally, we have Vladimir Putin in Moscow. We have Xi Jinping in China, you know, a more aggressive China, a more assertive China. And we may possibly have Donald Trump in the White House in the next 6 months.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what happens in this sort of febrile atmosphere if Donald Trump is the next American president? How dangerous is that, Tom?
Well, I think it's, he, in my view, presents a clear and present threat to the institutions of US democracy. Yeah. And he will pose a challenge to the fundamental strengths of their institutional processes, and the checks and balances of the US Constitution and the separation of powers. And you see the contempt with which he treats all of those institutions and, yes, and the various courts and judges he's appeared before. My guess would be that U.S. constitutional and democratic institutions are robust and that they will survive. But while that drama is playing out, he will continue to dilute and undermine the coherence of NATO as a transatlantic alliance that has been useful as a deterrence against Russian aggression. It'll embolden and empower Putin in Ukraine. It'll embolden and empower China in its efforts to, you know, flex its muscles in Asia and throughout the world, and in Africa particularly.
Taiwan being the obvious.
Yeah, I suppose what you're seeing is a shift in global power relations.
Yes.
But the terrible tragedy with Trump and some of the leadership figures we've had is just the betrayal of the kind of erosion of public trust in political leaders and politics as a system, and then leaders, you know, particular leaders. And if you want to ask, you, well, what does a society look like? What does the world look like when we lose trust in our political systems and in our leaders, and we have poor leadership, toxic leadership? What does that look like? Well, it looks like Capitol Hill. And it looks like Vladimir Putin and Prigozhin, you know, making a dash for Moscow. It's just chaos and instability. And what we need in the world is strong, ethical, powerful leadership. We need a commitment to peace. It has become very unfashionable to talk about peace in the last number of years. I made the dreadful mistake of signing a letter for the Irish Times in 2022 saying that we should focus our efforts as much on peace as we do on, you know, manufacturing ammunition. And it was like the gates of hell opened online. You know, it has become very, very unfashionable to talk about peace or peace building. And, you know, Ireland, we've a great record in that regard. I think our government have been very strong on both Gaza and now Iran, along with the Spanish, in terms of trying to provide some sort of ethical leadership. And, you know, maybe there's a grain of hope in all of this, that maybe this precipitous moment might bring us to our senses.
Let me ask two final questions, Tom. Does Israel have nuclear weapons? And the road back from where we are now, is it manageable?
So Israel absolutely has nuclear weapons. They have conventional nuclear weapons and they have smaller tactical ones.
And the Iranians are believed to be close to developing their nuclear weapons.
Again, if you recall, a couple of years ago, we had the nuclear expert from Pakistan who gave Iran the manufacturing instructions for assembling a nuclear weapon. And, you know, there is another story here. Like, Israel and the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, all of the Gulf states, the Sunni Gulf states, they're terrified of Iran going nuclear. And I mean, that's just meaning acquiring the means to generate nuclear power. Because once Iran goes nuclear, I think you'll see a nuclear arms race in the Gulf.
Yes.
So part of possibly Netanyahu's strategic thinking in relation to Iran's attack on Israel, that maybe this is an opportunity to really get in there and attack the regime before it goes nuclear, before it gets to that point. And is there a way of walking back from this? Of course there is, but the missing ingredient here is strong ethical leadership. And again, if you look at the cast of characters that we have globally, they're like, you know, from Hollywood central casting villains, including Mr. Trump, if he succeeds. And, you know, regionally, there isn't much cause for optimism or hope. Again, past behavior being the most reliable predictor for future behavior.
Okay, Tom, we're really grateful to you. Tom Clonan is a senator now since March 2022, an ardent campaigner for what is good, and he understands the peril that the Irish peacekeepers may be in and the conditions they live in this dangerous world. We're grateful to Tom, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.